Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality and is about discovering your place in this great universe from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Wellness Radio. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us here today. Today, we're going to be talking about a brand new topic. I'll tell you, we really haven't hashed this, nor have we discussed it, or even so, we haven't picked it apart on this show. So I think this is going to be a great show. We're going to be talking about Biohistory, Decline and Fall of the West by Jim Penman. And let me tell you, I looked at it and I said, what is biohistory? Decline and fall of the West? Who's the West? Who's the East? You know, some people say, I kind of get it. I'm not really sure. But that's okay. No wonders. Just sit back and kind of enjoy it for the ride. We're going to have a lot of new concepts put out there today. We're going to be talking about mental illness and our society and all of these different things. And, you know, it's really the only hope, Dr. Penman says, is our only hope may lie with the biological sciences. Well, society would tell us one thing, government tells us another, our spiritual essence tells us another. Hey, I'm open to Dr. Penman's controversy today. So, Dr. Penman, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a real pleasure to have you with us here from Australia.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you.
So, can you share a little bit with our listeners about your work? Because not everybody is familiar with anything you've ever done before, and neither am I, and I would love to hear.
Well, it started years ago when I did my PhD, and actually it was in the beginning, it was in the history department, and I was looking at civilizations and when they rose and how they fell, and also the difference between civilized societies with large governments and advanced economies and those with, more small-scale ones, hunter-gatherers and so forth. And one thing I noticed was that the family patterns were very different. In civilized societies, you have a certain set of family patterns. For example, control of sexual activity was a big one. Discipline of children, especially just control of children. Nuclear monogamous families. There was a whole and an ability to sort of plan and think and work for the future. There was a whole set of attitudes and structures that were associated with civilization. And I was trying to work out what this meant. Why do you find these kinds of patterns in civilized societies? Is it just random? And what I eventually came to understand is that it's kind of a biological pattern, that all these forms of behavior are actually associated in animals with food restriction. So you get animals like gibbons, for example, that live in very food-restricted environments, then they have these kinds of patterns of behavior which actually adjust them to the environment. And the same kind of attitudes and the same kind of behavior is good for making civilized societies.
Well, let's go step back for just a second. And, you know, I can remember speaking the other day on one of my radio shows, and people were really saying, oh, we're such an over-drugged-out society right now. Everybody's on antidepressants and how terrible it is, and we should be, you know, out picketing every single day to be able to get these out of society and all the companies and, you know, on and on and on about the activism. And I had made the statement, I said, but if you really look back at it, you see a lot of drugs that were given in the early 1900s when you had women who were having a lot of syphilis, you know. That's when cocaine and morphine started ramping up. And then you had to have turnaround and start having rehab. And then you had world wars, you know, and then people started doing the drinking thing. And then it was really nice to be able to start doing smoking. And really, that was looking at all of the society things that people were doing along the way and how healthcare has evolved, you know. And even look at when people started getting antibiotics. That was really, I think, the stepping stone to where we, I now call victim healthcare, where people would walk in, give me a pill, you're going to fix me, and I'll be out the door later, and we're good to go. Except that same mentality has stuck for a lot of the chronic and devastating terminal diseases these days, and we're still expecting those same parameters to occur for a cold as much as, or a sore throat, as much as we would for cancer and chronic illness. So I guess maybe I'm speaking correlating along what you're saying, and I think, you know, it's like all a big ball of concepts that are just evolving these days where we can start to look at, back at societies as you've done.
Mm-hmm. Look, a lot of these things are actually quite harmful. The kind of character, the personality behind civilization, advanced, is what I call C. Now, if you take something like an addictive drug like cocaine or heroin or any of those things or smoking, all of those undermine C. But the biggest thing that undermines it is simply prosperity. It's too much food. They're all called what I call C demoters. They all undermine this character. And what reinforces this character is not having quite as much food, but also behaviors like restricting sexual activity. They have the opposite effect, or any form of discipline, like Christian disciplines, like fasting or Sabbath keeping and so forth. So you might say that religion in the West, particularly Christianity, is trying to promote this kind of character, this civilized character, and all the wealth and the affluence and things like drugs and smoking are trying to drag it down. And at the moment, C is declining quite fast, which is why our civilization is in a lot of trouble. While we've got so much problem with, you know, stagnating economies and loss of faith in government.
And, you know, I think it's interesting when we say about, you know, when the Pope had recently come to the U.S., everybody was waiting with bated breath, thinking he was going to have this, quote, fix, and everything was going to be hunky-dory, except that didn't happen. You know, they were all... I've even heard commentators in the media even say, we were waiting for this big... I guess this big pompous or this big godlike comment or something that we could hang our hat on, and we didn't get it. So people were kind of, you know, defeated by that after the fact.
I think a lot of people were hoping that Pope Francis would be a lot more liberal, and he'd abandon a lot of traditional Catholic teaching, which he doesn't seem to have done. He's more compassionate, but he's in line with traditional Catholic teaching. But in actual fact, I would say he's right. I mean, I'm not a Catholic. I'm a evangelical. But those traditional values that the Catholic Church teaches are actually pretty healthy for society and for individuals, because it develops this C character. And one of the things that we're doing here, we're about to launch an institute called the Institute for Social Neuroscience to research and study these things. We're setting up a clinic particularly to deal with things like anxiety, depression, addictive disorders, alcoholism and drug addiction. And we're using the principles from my research to do that, because if you can increase the level of the C character, then you should be able to treat a lot of these things. We're also looking at chemistry, ways of medications and so forth, which you've been doing with animals with some success.
Because you look at Catholics, you know, on TV, they have all of these commercials, Catholics come home, and then they said that in the annulment factor, let's say, it used to take years, and now they say, well, it will take a shorter period of time. You can come home for that. And a lot of people will say who are, well, maybe have been raised Catholic in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, they have varying different concepts on the religion. Some still pray the same prayers that they learned when they were in grade school in the 50s, and others say, this doesn't work for me anymore. because it seems too controlling. I want to be freer. I want to be able to experience my lifestyle, the way I do things, just doesn't fit in anymore. And I think that's when they drop the religion, and most people don't realize. And I even had someone say to me the other day, are you spiritual or religious? And I went, I just kind of was dumbfounded by the question, you know. And so I guess maybe we could go down that road a little bit.
Well, the fact is that in the West in general, America, Australia too, the Catholic Church's teachings are far more conservative than what most of the members, most Catholics actually do. For example, contraception.
Right.
I mean, the Church says it's wrong. Most Catholics use it. Even abortion,
right.
A lot of different things, divorce, all kinds of stuff. So the Catholic Church is trying to hold the line with traditional values, but the idea that you can suddenly get people to come back and be Catholic because you relax all these teachings is actually not very sensible, because, in fact, if you look at Protestant churches, the churches that have say, you know, we're going to go and do what everybody else thinks in society and we're going to adopt the values, they're plummeting like a stone. Whereas the churches that hold for the most fundamentalist traditional beliefs, like fundamentalists and some charismatics and Mormons, people like that, are actually doing very, very well. Because the thing about spirituality and religion, they're not separate. These religious disciplines,
right.
Things like sexual disciplines on sexual behavior, for example, they actually create the character which helps to make people more spiritual. You can't separate them out too easily. They go together.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think...
Sorry.
I think more what they were trying to say was they felt that spirituality was actually no belief in any religious things, and that you were free and that you did not believe in God. And if you were religious, then you upheld every single one of the rules, and you were one of these... I mean, I'm a Roman Catholic by study, you know, I mean, I grew up that way and everything. And they really, if you don't concede to go to church every single Saturday or Sunday, and you make sure that you're following and doing abiding by all these laws, even if you defect to even one, you're not religious, you know. And that is a big deal to some people, and they will even segregate themselves if they believe that you're not within that same parameters. And I think that's what you're also talking about, you know, how people can migrate, you know. We've seen that migrations, you know. I lived in the Northeast. It was Irish Catholic and Italian Catholic and Polish Catholic. They all lived in that area. There wasn't any other type churches when I grew up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So, you know, the migration around this is, I guess, maybe what you're also talking about, how things can really fall off in a society.
Yeah, well, look, any kind of religiosity that condemns people for falling away, I think, is not very sensible. I mean, the Bible says if we have no sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. But if we confess our sins to God, he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. That's the basis of spirituality, of religion, to me, that we recognize that we aren't perfect. But it doesn't mean to say we shouldn't strive to be. I mean, people can be spiritual without being religious. I suppose you can have a sense of awe or something like that. But you're more likely to be spiritual if you are religious and you genuinely try to follow religious teachings. And that's not just Christianity too. I mean, it's the same as Hinduism and Buddhism and those countries. They all require a significant amount of personal discipline, not just doing whatever you feel like.
Right. You also talk about how there are differences in temperament, you know, and you talk about hormones and epigenetics. Wow. That little short, tiny phrase, and I go, whoa, tell me more. And what does that really mean?
Well, this is actually how the C system works. What I call C, this C character that's behind civilization and also behind these advanced religions. If you do something that's what I call a C promoter, if you restrict your sexual activity or if you go on a fast or if you discipline yourself in various ways, there's an actual hormonal change going on. And one aspect of this is it reduces the level of testosterone. Now, people think testosterone is something great and wonderful and it's all manly and vigorous and stuff, but testosterone is things that's associated with drug addiction, with criminality, with not getting a good education, all kinds of things. It's not a very positive thing with a lot of violence. Testosterone is not. So if you reduce the level of testosterone, you have a more disciplined, productive, more positive sort of character in many ways. And what they're also... There are also long-term effects, particularly when you do this in, say, in childhood, say parental discipline, or in adolescence. And what they do, these changing hormones, they change the way your genes function. This is called epigenetics. What they do, it turns on or off certain genes, which has a permanent effect on character. So, like, if you go through a fast, for example, then your level of testosterone is going to drop, but then if you stop fasting, it'll come back. But if you do these things, especially in crucial periods of life, early life, the effect becomes relatively permanent. That's epigenetics.
So if, let's say, you have lower testosterone and you kind of have control over things and you have people that are... So is low testosterone associated with addictions? But then wouldn't high testosterone be associated with anger and rebellion in a society?
Addiction, yes. High testosterone, well, it can be actually. That's anger and rebellion is more of a stress thing. But what anything like excess food or cocaine or anything else tends to do is to increase testosterone, at least short term. In the long term, it has a different effect because if you're a drug addict or you become obese, for example, then your body starts to collapse and your testosterone levels actually drop. So it's a bit complicated. But in essence, anything that increases testosterone undermines this C character. So you don't want to do that. And that's why, for example, even things like smoking is another example, even caffeine can have this undermining effect. Because it's a caffeine increases testosterone.
And so sometimes you would like to think of it in the phases of acute and chronic, and also depletion, because you may have something that will stimulate you. You will have something go on. We can think of it in society. You know, we really want to say, I'm looking at this and I want to become an activist for it, and you socialize out for change. But then you also turn around and say, okay, then I did my part, and then you go back in line kind of idea. In other words, you go back into a sort of balance, whereas some people, they can really, as we've seen many times, they can actually burn themselves out, which we all call adrenal failure, but also when they burn themselves out too, that's when, as you said, it really becomes a real serious problem.
Yeah. Well, look, in my view, even moderate amounts of these kind of people may not become, you know, heavily addicted and so forth. After all, most of the men who took up heroin in Vietnam during the Vietnam War actually came back and had no long-term effect. It's only a minority that become this terrible addiction. But I'd say even smallish amounts are not a good thing. They're not good for character. They may not destroy you. But it's the same thing with excess eating or smoking or just lack of discipline in your private life or not controlling your children. All these things are harmful. They're harmful to individuals and they're harmful to society. And this is where, again, I think Catholic doctrine or traditional Christian doctrine in general is very healthy. I mean, the way I look upon it as a Christian is that God made us. And he designed this, and he knows how he works. And if you understand all the teachings of the Bible, they're very much inclined to create this kind of C character, which is good for people and good for society.
Interesting. Because sometimes we like to think that as we grow and change, you know, we look back on, let's use women as an example, in the 30s and 40s, they were very submissive and victims. And we look at women now where they're fighting for equal rights and, you know, that is something that's, you know, changing with history too. And definitely that's an issue with, could you look at it as power? Could you look at it as equality, as hormones? Could you look at it as epigenetics? I'm not sure.
This equality of women is to do with another characteristic, and I don't want to confuse it too much, but it's called V, and it's a sort of the patriarchal, aggressive, warlike kind of character. And that's been dropping quite drastically, actually since the 16th century. And declining stress levels in terms of we don't punish our children so much is all part of that. That's for the most part, it's a fairly healthy kind of change in society. When you get a lower level of V and a relatively high level of C is when you get the most creative kinds of people and the best functioning societies. Like say, the West in the mid-20th century, even in the 60s and 70s and so forth. But the trouble with that is that this V characteristic, this aggressive, patriarchal thing, actually tends to support C to some extent. So it's, in a way, it's all part of the civilization decline, even though the effects in terms of greater equality and so forth are actually quite positive in the short term.
Interesting. Let's see. You also talk about tipping points with wars and revolution. You see where we are in the U.S. these days. It's tumultuous from one day to the next. And, you know, almost you, if you don't get up and you don't look at the news on the television, you're not quite sure what you might be stepping out into in the day. So what do you see is going on in the world at this present point, and are we at that tipping point of no return?
We're actually, I mean, like in historical terms, we're still in a fairly healthy situation where you know, wealth may not be rising as much as it was, but it's not declining and society is stable. But there's a number of very worrying trends, which you can understand in terms of my theory, in terms of this continuing decline C. For example, as I said, economies are stagnating rather than rising. There's a growing gap between rich and poor. There's a increasing cynicism about government, which is why people like, Donald Trump,
right,
Bernie Sanders, and so people are going for extremist views. They've lost faith in mainstream politics. You've got declining birth rate. We're no longer having enough children to replace ourselves. There are trends like this that are happening. There's other trends people haven't noticed, like, I think that there's evidence of a declining resistance to infectious disease. There are some signs this is happening, and things like TB are starting to come back. And what my theory suggests is that this is going to become much, much, much worse as time goes on, that we're heading towards a really serious civilization decline, not only economic stagnation, but the end of democracy itself, and a return to a much more harsh, primitive, superstitious age, which I find not very agreeable, not a good idea.
Do we find that if we might end up, you know, getting to that pinnacle, I mean, we'd just drop off, and as you said, this harsher society, where I think a lot of people say, oh, we're getting back to nature, we're getting back to spirituality, we're getting back to humanity, taking care of each other and everything. And my thought is, generally, how can you take a really super aggressive society, participants, and people who have so many different varied habits, lifestyles, beliefs, societies, governments, and all of a sudden it's sort of like we're going to turn on Adam and Eve time again. I don't see how that's fitting in, and I think that's what you're trying to say, correct?
Yes, that's right. Look, in a sense, we are reverting to more natural behavior, you know, towards what our species arose as. We basically traditionally hunter-gatherers. But the trouble is the C characteristic, this disciplined, hardworking, build large states, market economies, is quite artificial. It's quite hard to produce and to maintain. And we are moving towards a more natural lifestyle. But that's a character that's really, really good at living in small bands, hunting and gathering food, warring with neighboring tribes. It's not going to work very well in a society like ours. I mean, apart from anything else, there are about 1,000 times too many of us. You can't mm-hmm. support that many people with that kind of system. So natural is fine, but we're not hunter-gatherers. And when most people have to starve to return to that.
Yeah, I think we've moved past that in our society by all of the things that we do in our life. We've changed our lives so differently, I'm not sure we could ever go back. And then also, too, as you've said, I mean, you would really have to, a lot of family lines would be extinct at that point, and because how could you support the system, you know?
That's right. Well, what's actually likely to happen is not so much a return to hunter-gatherer, that's not possible, but a spread of Islam in particular, or religions that had much the same idea, much more impoverished societies, much more rigid in their thinking, extremely patriarchal and so forth. I think, as things go, it's pretty well inevitable that Europe will become an Islamic continent within, you know, a century or two, because the Muslims are more resistant to this process of decline than anyone else, and they have more children, and they hang on to their values, and the Christian West is so feeble. Whether it'll happen in America, I don't know, but that's clearly the trend of what's going on. One of the things, though, that my theory does say is that it could be possible to reverse this if we understood it. We've already done things in rat experiments that suggest that you can actually use, say, pheromones or potentially epigenetic treatments to medicate people, which means initially what it'll be is a way of treating, you know, things like alcoholism and drug addiction. But if these methods were accepted and spread, then, you know, you could reverse the decline of the society, so it doesn't need to happen, so that we could maintain a relatively humane and wealthy society. It is possible, but you have to know the science. It's all in the biology.
And also, you look at mental health in the U.S. is really, it's out of control. And they have been trying to capture it with medications, and it really is really not working. So mental health, I think, is really a big concern in this whole time frame, correct?
Mm. Yes, exactly right. And things like this growing incidence of depression, which you can trace by the way that suicide is becoming more and more common, especially I think it's the major cause of death amongst young people these days. This is part of this whole process, and what my theory suggests is that you could actually provide treatments that don't just treat the symptoms like lithium and so forth, but actually come to the basic roots of what's going wrong and treat that. That you could help people to change their character in a way which is positive and takes away the basic need for recession. You see, a lot of things go wrong in childhood. I mean, and they've done experiments with animals, and it's obvious with people too. If you suffer abuse or if you suffer, you're likely to become depressed. But what's happened is it's all epigenetic. There's changes to your genes that are actually causing really, really bad effects and can lead, you know, years or decades later to committing suicide, for example. But if you understand the biology, it should be possible to go back and actually provide a medication that will completely obliterate these bad effects. So a person
if you look at the new study, the ACEs study, the adverse child experiences, you know, events, that's quite profound. And I live in the southern part of the U.S., and they came here to talk to us about it, the person that was working on the study, and they said they neglected to put in the top 10, number 11 should have been witness a natural disaster. And I've seen it, you know, here after Hurricane Katrina. We're now 10 years out, and we're finding that mental health is off the wall, and the crime is out of control. And the crime that's out of control is from young men 15 to 25. And if you look at it, we're 10 years out now. Where were those kids 10 years ago? They were 5 to 15. Their parents couldn't take care of them. They were struggling. Everybody was in survival mode. Everything they knew was gone. So now what's going to happen 10 years later? Of course, they're fighting for their own survival. which is the same thing that they were fighting for 10 years ago. So it's very much the same thing. And unless you find a way to be able to address this throughout the time instead of just pushing it off with drugs and medication, you're getting nowhere. Now you're just getting what I call crime on steroids, because they now have absolutely no inhibitions and get out of their way because they are just going to terrorize.
Yes, look, you're completely right. The drugs and the medication are an attempt to treat symptoms, and they're a very bad one. But the effects of these kinds of traumas, as many other things, parental neglect, lack of all kinds of things that go on, things that your parents do, they're permanent. They're actually locked into the way that our genes function. Certain genes, as a result of Hurricane Katrina and the experiences, certain genes in these young people have been turned off or turned on.
Right.
That's causing them to behave very badly. The really exciting thing is that the recent developments in science suggest that you can actually do something about this. Now, I don't want to go too technical, but there's a treatment that's called CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R, it's all capitalized, which has been developed, and it's a gene editing technique. It's a way of changing genes, but it can also be used to reset these epigenetic settings, to change them, to say, okay, this is what's happened as a result of the trauma. These are the epigenetic settings that have happened. Let's develop a treatment that can actually reverse all this and make it so that they never experience these bad effects. So a child could come up through a horrific experiences of abuse and so forth, and we could say, okay, we know what's happened. This is something that will actually make that as if it didn't happen. It'll take away the bad effects. It's incredibly exciting, this new epigenetic research.
And that would be absolutely profound change in society. I mean, I think that would be, you know, the, gosh, I don't know. That would just be incredible. I mean, that would be known for, centuries on. Because when you look at these kids, they're going nowhere fast. And all government does is let's just let them shoot each other. And when they're finished, there'll be no more of them left. That's their theory. And they just let them go at it. Hey, if they're out shooting in the middle of the street, take a little while to get to the shootout and see how many are down. And it's so unfortunate to see that there is not anything in society currently to be able to help them. There's no mental health beds, not enough for them. The jails are overloaded. In fact, the brand new jail since the storm is now half the size that it was before. Does that make any sense? No. But it's just the way they're starting to limit society, bad behavior in a society, by limiting the sources that are available for them.
Yes. Look, we need to address these issues. If it looked at from my point of view, I'd say the number one most sensible thing that society could do to address these sort of evils is basic scientific research in biology, especially in this field, epigenetics. I mean, we spent, America spent, $1.6 trillion on fighting in the Middle East. And what has that achieved? If you've taken like even 5% of that and put it into some really basic research into the causes of these kinds of problems, I think the difference to the world will be 1,000 times. If you assume the Middle East war has achieved anything at all, that is, I would say it hasn't. Because basically, when you said before about society is very important, people think that governments think that you can make laws and you can change society. It's not correct. People change society. It's individual character that matters, not government programs in the end. If people are disciplined, if they're hardworking, if they're compassionate, you're going to have a well-functioning society. And if people are traumatized, if they're ill-disciplined, you're going to have a much, much worse form of society. We've got to have individuals have to change.
And also, too, right there, what you're saying is that if you have these victimized if you have these people who are really having all of this negative stuff go on to them, and then they end up turning around as a victim, they will see government as the saving grace, and that will change and alter the society, when really it's more of a passive thing where they think everybody's outside of them versus, as you've said, making the changes inside of themselves. In other words, they need to be participants in life. They can't just be a victim of it.
That's right. People do sort of blame the government, says up to government to help me out, you know. But really, it is up to the individual. People have an enormously exaggerated idea of what a government can do. They really can't do very much at all. I mean, you look at things like the birth rate. A lot of societies are concerned about declining birth rate, and they have all these programs to try and fix it. It doesn't work. They just don't work. People don't, you know, subsidies and stuff won't make people have more children. I love the fact that you've got, I've 4 children, is that right? Successful
yeah.
career. But people have, like, children less and less. And that's not something you can change by government program. It's to do with individual character. It's what we want to do.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you, the life, when I grew up in the 50s and 60s, life was so different, vastly different than it is today. And I can even say up until, even the year 2000 until now, everything is changing so fast. Haven't you found that?
Yes, absolutely. I find it very difficult with my children. I'm trying to bring them. I have 10 children, by the way, but I'm trying to bring up my younger children in a way that's a bit more like that, a more disciplined, a little bit more austere kind of life, so that they won't be so spoiled by the society. But the pressures are enormous because all their school friends are used to being treated in certain ways. So when I try and say, restrict them from watching television or playing computers in certain times, they find that very difficult because they're not all their peers are treated so differently.
And you know what I'll tell you? We say that there's a lot of peer pressure in young, but there is. But I'll tell you, you know what I've found, and I've said this recently, I'm really finding that there's more peer pressure as an adult than there is as a child. Because the more peer pressure there is as an adult does not allow that adult to stand on their own 2 feet and tell their children no. Do you know what I mean? Because they're more afraid what what mother's going to say or what the school's going to say or their husband's going to say and if they don't do this, that, or the other. So there's so much more peer pressure as an adult these days than ever before.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And the peer pressure comes from all over. It comes from your children's friends. It comes from other people to act in a certain way that society thinks is appropriate. And I think it's bad. Look, I grew up too. I was born in 1952, so I grew up in the 50s and 60s as well. And it wasn't, in a lot of ways, a much better and healthier society. And I actually think that baby boomers like myself were very privileged. We didn't have all this electronic stuff, so I used to read a great deal. And we used to go and play outside in a way the kids are sort of hunched over their screens and so forth. I mean, I love what the internet does, but sometimes it's a very malign influence. And things like, you know, the availability of pornography and all those kinds of things too. And in a lot of ways, it's very, very destructive. And in a lot of ways, the way we were brought up was a lot healthier and better. And I think our kids are going to suffer for it as they get older.
Yeah, I certainly do. My children now, the oldest, are in their 30s, and they grew up, we grew up in the Northeast, and that's where we lived at the time with the kids, and, you know, there was not really any fast foods that were around that we went to all the time. My kids didn't have birthday cakes because, hey, they just weren't interested in sugar. It was no big deal. They were outside all the time, and they did not have electronics because they grew up without them. But I'll tell you now, as they're in their 30s, they still don't eat at fast food places. They don't have birthday cakes, and they could care less about some of the technology. So I guess maybe that was the breaking point was, you know, around that age group where then it just clicked and turned, where we're seeing, you know, babies and children with, you know, these pads and that stuff and those cell phones carrying them around. And I'm going, I am so thankful that I'm not raising any of those kids because I just don't know if I could do it.
Yes, well, I think you've obviously had some fairly traditional ideas in the way you brought up your children, which is very healthy, and I would guess as a result of that, they've probably done quite well. And I think that's part of the secret of it. Look, I'm actually fairly well off. I run a very successful business, and we could live in an incredible life of luxury if we want to. We very deliberately live in a very simple fashion. But when I was a kid, soft drink was something you had at Christmas time. It was just, you know, you just drank water or milk. Sometimes you get cordial, but it was unbelievably different. My family only had one rather old car. We were quite well off by the standards of the time, but it was very different.
Did you also, and I always tell people this, and they say, no, you're telling me a lie, but we would have one pair of shoes for school and one pair of shoes for outside, and that was it. Not 10 and 20 pairs of shoes.
Yeah, pretty much like that. Really was right. Different. We lived in a fairly small house with four children. People would think we were living in poverty. I mean, most people on the dole live better than these days than we did, you know, colour television and air conditioning and all those kind of things, but... You know, you didn't miss it. It was just part of life. And the houses weren't so heated. We had a wood fire. So if you wanted to get cold, if you were cold, you put on a jumper or move near the fire. I mean, it wasn't considered that bad. We were a comfortable family.
Right.
We were well off by the standards of the time. But I think that is healthy. We've got too much, Jeanette. There's too much wealth. There's too much comfort.
Right.
There's too much food. There's too much drugs. It's not healthy. It's great to have our minds expanded by the internet. I mean, I love something like Wikipedia and the efficiencies in business and so forth. But the affluent society is killing us. It's destroying our character and it's destroying our society. And it's too much.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time together. I was wondering if you could share how you think you see society going and what would we as individuals say, maybe I should make this change. And, you know, what should we be alerted to, I think, in some different areas? Because, obviously, we would like to see things, you know, and have a great life. But sometimes some people say, I'm stuck on this bandwagon and I can't get my derriere off of it, you know?
Look, society is going down in a bad way. I don't think there's any doubt about it. And if you look at the trends, and in the last chapter of my book, there's a whole series of graphs about all the things that are happening, and they make a very depressing picture. If you want to fight against that, it really means going back to the values and the lifestyle of a traditional society, particularly 150 years ago, which means traditional
right.
Christianity, if that's possible, or some traditional form of religion. Now, Judaism is much the same thing in terms of its values. A more simple existence, not so much affluence, not so much food, certainly not taking drugs and those kinds of things. More discipline in personal life, more discipline with our children. That's the healthier society, and children who can be raised that way, they'll be better for it. But it's ferociously difficult. It's really, really difficult to go against the trend of everyone around you. Even the very air is changing. There's pheromones in the air that are dragging us down in this process. But the other side of it too, that's as an individual, I think we can fight against the trend, as I certainly do with my family. But the other side, the only real hope in the long term is in science. And I would say to anybody, the biological sciences, we need to support them in a much, we need to treble, quadruple. We need to put 10 times the resources. We need to have people trained in these areas. It's the only hope for society. It's more important than computers. It's more important than physics. It's more important than chemistry. The biological sciences is the key to the survival of our society. It's the only way we can survive.
And also to encourage your children in this. You know, I can remember, you know, when you were a kid, didn't you used to go out and play in the dirt and you would make a circle like a moat of dirt and you'd put water in the middle? And then I come here to New Orleans and that's how the levees are around the city. And I'm thinking, oh, they must have played in the dirt as kids. Do you know what I mean? So if you can turn around and take your children and start teaching them some things when they're younger, that will gradually increase their inquisitiveness and inspire them to be able to think about things in a different way. I know I've had my share. I mean, I've got 13 or 14 years of college, and all of my kids have, you know, masters and all of these other things. So they're all doing pretty well. But we've all been educated enough to be able to say that what we learned when we were younger, we kind of took that even further. I used to come home and talk about open heart surgery at lunch, you know, when my kids were 2 to 10. And they'd be like, oh, gosh, what about that? But one or two of them really picked up on it, and that one is going to be a medical emergency room physician. So, you know, in other words, don't shelter your children so much to the fact that what's going on in biology, what's going on in life, and being able to stand up and say, hey, you know, this is, look at this. And your kids might turn around and say, oh, did you ever try this? You just never know. And that gets them to start thinking and they along those lines. How about even with physics? You know, when you're taking a play car or truck that has no motor on it and you're pushing it up the wall and you're saying, oh, my arm is getting tired. Is your arm getting tired or are you going against gravity? Or how heavier does it feel now that it's up there when it's down on the bottom on the baseboard? You know, teach those principles. I think we need to be educated parents to be able to teach principles to our children instead of totally giving up and saying, let some other system or some other people teach my kids because, hey, you know, I got to go out to dinner tonight or whatever else I'm doing, you know?
Yeah, look, what you're saying is very correct. And I think in the most general sense, the time we spend with our children, teaching them, talking to them, training them, educating them, there's no substitute. Mm-hmm. We tend to think we can push it off to specialists and educators and special classes. I think this rushing around to one event after is actually very destructive. Children need their parents. They need that guidance, just exactly what you've done with your kids. And they've obviously turned out well. That is the key. And as a society, we're losing interest in children. We don't like children or want them as much as we used to. And we need to go back to wanting children and loving to spend time with them.
You know, it's the funniest thing. If you look at a lot of the mommy blogs that are on the internet, they say, oh, they need a date night. Oh, they need a nanny. Or, hey, you know, do you really want me to get up at night to take care of my kid? And it's like they get nighttime nannies. And I'm going, what in the heck is going on? So you and I, hey, you and I are preaching to the choir. But I think there's a lot of, as we say, generations out there that are going to have a super tough time when really – you know, things start shaking, rattling, and rolling, and things start not working anymore.
That's right. Disengaged parents is the worst of all. I spend a lot of time with my kids. My 6-year-old has a bit of trouble with reading, so every day I sit down, I'm going through the McGuffey readers with him and just going and teaching him and talking to him. And constant, ongoing training and engagement. That is effective parenting, not giving it to somebody else, to some specialist. Absolutely.
Well, Jim, it has been a very active time talking to you today. I'll tell you, we didn't even stop for a breath, and I told you that we would just go right around to the front door. We were good. It was great having you and speaking with you today.
Yeah, it's been great. It's been great. I really love talking to you. I could see from your blog that we probably, from your description, that we get on very well. I love your values, Jeanette. I think they're fantastic. You do a great job there talking about such things, and I wish there was more voices like yours around.
Well, you know, thank you so much for that, because I really feel that, like I said, as we can say things a million different times, keep doing it, because others have different things going on in their lives. And if we can resonate with even one or two words or a sentence, somebody could say, oh, I just heard that. That's intriguing. That's something that, you know, may stimulate me to think about something else. Or even if you and I say a word like the word biohistory, they'll say, I don't know what that is, but they'll go to the internet and they'll look it up. That's what we want. We want people to become engaged, to become out there and just be more engaged instead of being victims, you know, and passive. We want you to be a participant. So thank you so much for being on the show today, Jim. It was a real pleasure. Can you share with the listeners how to find out more information about you?
The best, our blog, www.biohistory.org. It talks about the books. It also gives some brief videos which explain the outline of how biohistory works.
That is fabulous. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and it's been a real pleasure to have you on today.
Thank you, Jeanette. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. If you'd like to find out more information about Jim Penman, again, his book is Biohistory, Decline and Fall of the West. The link is on the bottom of today's show page. Please do check it out, and it'll go directly to his website. And please, just even listen again to the show, and you may find two or three words, and you'd say, I want to look up something else. I want to find out some more information about this, or, gosh, I must be really derailed. I need to get back on. Or maybe I'm doing a great job. And that's really what it's all about. So thank you so much for joining us today. Have a wonderful day. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and until tomorrow, have a great day.
Today we discuss many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.